And now, please join me in welcoming Malcolm Gladwell.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here in New Hampshire. I was trying to think. I think this is my fourth visit. I hope it's my most fun visit. The others were all in the winter, so this bodes well. I thought what I would do is tell you a random story from the book, and then, because I don't want to upstage any of the discussion that comes later. And it's a story about before I came to the real subject of this book, which is an examination of the death of Sandra Bland. I was kind of searching around for a topic that would engage my imagination. And I have this kind of rule that I use about what are the kinds of memoirs that I read. I think memoirs are an extraordinarily good source of ideas for writers. But my rule is as follows. You don't want to read the memoir of the famous person because they've had a really, really interesting life, but they're not going to share any of it with you because they're famous. Like, there's stakes involved. They can't diss, you know, other famous people or they'll get in trouble. So they're high on the potentially interesting, low on the actually interesting. Then on the other hand, you don't want to read a memoir by someone who isn't famous because they will tell you everything, but they have nothing to tell you, right? Their lives have not been that interesting. What you really want is the sweet spot in the middle. You want the mid-range biography. So I read lots of mid-range memoirs, and I was reading a classic mid-range memoir, was a memoir I was reading by the former general counsel of the CIA. Now, that's perfect. Who's ever heard of the general counsel of the CIA? No one has, but he's the general counsel of the CIA. So he's like, he's had a super interesting life, but he's not so famous that he's concerned about burning all his bridges. He made reference in his memoir to another memoir by an equally mid-range writer named Brian Littell, who is a former CIA operative official who used to run the Latin America desk of the CIA. Again, right in the middle. I read that one, and I went to see Brian Littell because it was so interesting. Because there was a particular story he tells, which really caught my eye, involving a guy named Florentino Espiaga. So I go down to Miami and I meet with Brian Littell, and he tells me a little bit about Florentino, and he says, but I can't tell you anymore because there's one person who knows all of the full story, and his name is, I can only refer to him as the mountain climber. And the mountain climber was this legendary CIA operative who was witness to some of the most extraordinary events of the last 25 years. So I said, well, how can I get in touch with the mountain climber to hear more about the story of Florentino Espiaga? And Brian Littell said, I can't tell you. I can't tell you where he is. I cannot even tell you his real name. But I can only tell you that were you to find the mountain climber, he would shed an enormous light on this story. So he was basically waving the red flag in front of the bull. So what did I do for the next 2 years of my life? I tried to find a mountain climber, of course. And I'm not a very good reporter, I should say. But in this particular area of finding the mountain climber, I like to think that I excelled. And I sent out all kinds of feelers, and I went to enormous lengths. I spent an epic amount of time trying to find a mountain climber. And one day, I looked at my phone, and I saw I had a message, and I had listened to the message, and it was, hello, this is the mountain climber. I understand you've been looking for me. And I was like, so I called him up, and I wanted to go see him, but of course, couldn't go see him. And he said he would agree to talk to me, but only if, and he called me from one of those, every now and again you get those calls where it just says, I don't know if you ever got this, it just says no number. You ever seen those? The mountain climber called me from a no number line. And he told me the full story of Florentino Espiaga. Now, it's important to know, before I go on about this, that the mountain climber was a legend. The mountain climber was one of the, he was the kind of Michael, the LeBron James of CIA operatives. In his day, everyone worshipped the mountain climber. When the mountain climber was in Eastern Europe, the Soviets used to have courses for their young KGB officers in training that were about the mountain climber, about like this is what it means to be a great spy, and you should learn at the feet of the mountain climber. For a while, the mountain climber was in, he ran the CIA's Cuba espionage operation out of Havana, and the Cubans worshipped him. He was like, they knew that there was this American in their midst who was incredible, and they just thought he was a kind of hero. It would be like, you know, a superhero had descended into your little city. And he, at one point, I don't know if this is apocryphal, the Soviets tracked down the mountain climber, and they had like big briefcases full of cash. And they just opened the briefcases and they said, if you just come and work with us, this is all yours. We'll just make you, we'll give you millions of dollars in cash. And of course, the mountain climber was like, would have none of it. He spoke a million languages, always like a native. His tradecraft was impeccable. He was the spy's spy. He made James Bond look like a bungler. This is how good the mountain climber is. So I tracked down the mountain climber, and I say, will you tell me about Florentino Aspiaga? And he gives me this big histrionic sigh and says, okay, I will. Florentino was someone high up in the Cuban intelligence service who was transferred to run Cuba's intelligence operations in Czechoslovakia. This is during the Cold War in the 1980s. And he decides to defect. And because he's grown disillusioned with Fidel Castro, and he crosses the border with his girlfriend in the trunk of his Mazda, and he shows up at the U.S. Embassy in Vienna and says, my name is Florentino Aspiaga. I'm a senior official in the Cuban Intelligence Directorate. I have a story to tell. And of course, they are thrilled that he has come over. And they ship him immediately to a debriefing center in Frankfurt at a U.S. Army base where the CIA sends all of the defectors. And they sit him down and they say, tell us your story. And he says, I will, but first, I have one request. And they say, what is the request? He says, I would like you to bring over someone who I have admired my entire life, the mountain climber. So the CIA calls the mountain climber, who's like on some secret location, and they fly him into Frankfurt. And the mountain climber comes into the room where Florentino is, and they meet each other and they give each other a big hug and a kiss on both cheeks. And the mountain climber sits down with Florentino Aspiaga and he says, tell me your story. And Florentino says, El Alpinista, Spanish for mountain climber. When you were in Havana running the CIA's operations, you were my hero. I worship you. I followed your every move. I wanted you to be present when I told you this story. You know you ran a ring of spies when you were in Havana. Mountain climber says, yes, of course I did. He said, and Florentino says, well, you know this one guy you had who you met so in such a place, and he worked for this government ministry, and he told you the following secrets. And mountain climber says, yes. Florentino says, that guy was working for us. He was a double agent. And the mountain climber is like, oh my God, that's devastating. And then Florentino says, I'm not done. You know this other guy you had who worked for this agency and gave you the following secrets? He was working for us too. And the mountain climber is like, this is the worst day of his life. And then Alpinista says, oh, I'm not done. You know this other spy you had who worked for the Ministry of Defense and told you this? He was working for us too. And the mountain climber at this point has lost the capacity for speech. He's so in shock. But Florentino's not done. He then proceeds to name 48 spies, the entire contingent of spies that the mountain climber was running in Havana in his years there. And Florentino reveals that every single one of them was a double agent working for Fidel Castro the whole time. The greatest field operative of his generation had been fooled not once, not twice, but 48 times over the course of many, many years. Now, this is a super interesting story for a number of reasons. One is that when we think about what kinds of people are misled, right, who are victims of scams, we always think that the victim of a scam fits a certain pattern. They're impaired in some way, they're gullible, they're aged and infirm. They're, you know, they always have some problem that allows them to be victims of deception. The mountain climber has none of those problems. The mountain climber is as good as it gets, yet he still gets deceived. Fascinating thing number two is that when we think of deception, we think that deception of that scale is something that happens once, right? You get fooled once, and then you get wise to it. Well, the mountain climber's not fooled once. He's fooled 48 times over the course of many, many years. In fact, this large-scale Cuban deception went on for more than a decade before it was uncovered. And the third thing we think is that when we see some kind of large-scale deception like this, it must be due to the brilliance of the deceiver, right? That the deceiver must be someone possessed of unusual cunning, who has some kind of evil genius, and that evil genius is what allows them to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. But in the case of the Cubans and the mountain climber, it's not clear at all that the Cubans were particularly great at what they did, right? This is a small country with a limited budget, working relatively crudely. And in fact, when you look at other cases of spies, you see the same pattern. The spies themselves are rarely geniuses. There was another Cuban spy named Ana Montes, whose story I tell in my book, who rose to the very highest levels of American intelligence, even as she was giving away everything she found out back to Fidel Castro. She was a terrible spy. She kept her codes in her purse. After 10 years, they finally busted her. They discovered that she had the radio that she used to communicate with her Cuban handlers inside a shoebox in her closet. This is like amateur hour, right? So these three puzzles make us, I think, force us to face up to a very, very uncomfortable truth, which is that being deceived is not the property of some kind of outlying, impaired person. Rather, it's something that happens to even the best of us who are highly skilled at what we do, right? And that even the best of us who are highly skilled at what we do can be deceived over and over again for many, many years without realizing that we're being deceived in that way. And that, to me, is an extraordinarily important fact in trying to understand about the ways the world works, right? That perhaps the capacity for being deceived is something that lies within all of us. And maybe one of the tasks we have as human beings is to learn how to adapt to our fundamental gullibility. Anyway, so that is one of the stories that got me off on the project that is talking to strangers, which I'm about to talk about a whole lot more. So thanks for coming, and we'll go on to part two.
Well, Malcolm Gladwell, this is an honor. Thank you so much for coming to New Hampshire for Writers on a New England Stage.
I am delighted.
So we'll talk a lot about what's in your book, and the book just came out a couple of days ago. Chances are most folks here have not read it. I should say that whatever we talk about here will not spoil it for you. It is an amazing experience to follow the narrative that you've crafted here. So this will be a fun chat. Let's start by talking about default to truth, because that's a big premise in this book.
Yeah.
The idea that we as human beings are programmed to trust the people that we don't know. Tell us a little bit about default to truth.
Yeah, this is an idea that comes from a very brilliant psychologist named Tim Levine, who inspired a lot of this book. And Levine was trying to solve an age-old puzzle that has obsessed psychologists for many years, which is, why are we so bad at knowing whether someone's lying to us? This has been subtested hundreds of different ways, but basically we're terrible at it. We're slightly better than chance at knowing whether we're being lied to. And you would think that we would be good at it, because you would think that evolution would favor those who were skilled at detecting deception, and it has not. And so the issue for years among psychologists has been, why are we bad at this, right? We're good at so many things. And Levine's answer is, we're bad at it because we did not evolve to be truth detectors. We evolved the opposite way. We evolved to be default truthers, to be people who implicitly trust each other. Because if you give everyone the benefit of the doubt and assume that everyone you're talking to is telling the truth, your life is a lot easier, right? Who succeeds in the world? Not the paranoid. The people who succeed in the world are the people who trust each other, right? Who starts companies? Not paranoid, suspicious people. People who trust, right? Who has a happy, productive home life? The kind of person who basically thinks the world is pretty good, right? You know, I could go on, and Levine's point is like, look, the world, the wonderful society that we built is based on this notion of just assuming those around you are telling the truth. And most people are telling the truth, so it's not a bad strategy, except that every now and again, like if you're the mountain climber, you're going to be an easy prey to a dedicated liar, in that case, the Cuban Intelligence Service. And Levine's point is that you just have to accept that. That's just the price of being human. We should stop fretting about how we gave all our money to Bernie Madoff and just get on with our lives. And I think he's not wrong. I think it's a really, really important consideration.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Bernie Madoff, because that's one of the examples I want to dive into, because there was at least one person who saw what Bernie Madoff was doing and did not feel in any way incentivized to disbelieve the numbers that he was seeing. Harry Markopoulos.
Yeah.
Tell us about him.
Yeah, so Madoff's around for years, for decades on Wall Street, and he's managing billions of dollars. And there are lots of people on Wall Street who don't understand how he's making his money. But their doubts don't, because they default to truth, their doubts do not rise to the level where they will cease to give Madoff the benefit of the doubt. One guy, a guy named Harry Markopoulos, does not have such a sunny view of Bernie Madoff. From the beginning, Harry Markopoulos says, the guy's a fraud. And he proves it 19 different ways, chapter and verse, goes to the SEC on numerous occasions and says, the guy's a fraud. And the SEC says, oh, I don't know. We went to see him. He was awfully convincing. No one will listen to Harry Markopoulos. And finally, when Madoff is, remember, turned in by his sons, Markopoulos becomes this kind of hero, is the guy, the only guy who saw the truth. So the question is, do you want to be like Harry Markopoulos? Do you want to be the one who was able to see through the lies of Bernie Madoff? So I went to see Markopoulos, and I also read his memoir, which is one of those middle memoirs. And if you read the memoir, you're like, huh. He's really a bit odd. And then I went to see him. He lives in Boston. But he would be the first to agree that he's a little bit odd. And I sat down with him in Boston, and we had a very long conversation during which he revealed himself to be more than a little odd. He is the kind of person you would be if you suspected everyone of deceiving you. He can't go 5 feet without thinking he's about to be tricked or scammed, or he thinks that, you know, lift a rock, and he thinks that there is some kind of Ponzi scheme under it.
Well, part of that was his upbringing, right? Like, he grew up in a restaurant industry, his family owned the restaurant, and he saw people walk out of the back of the restaurant with his family's inventory.
His family owned a chain of Treacher's, Arthur Treacher's fish and chips, which I don't think exists anymore, probably for good reason. But yeah, he just grew up, I mean, he's just like, but I think, you know, I wonder whether his upbringing, I don't mean to say that someone who grows up in the fast food business is prone
That's
to
not
suspicion
what I'm saying, no. I'm simply saying he was exposed at an early age to the reality that some people are very dishonest,
yes,
and they will take advantage,
yes,
and fast forward years later, and he's seeing Bernie Madoff take advantage of people.
Yes. He is just inclined, and the incredible thing is, so he sees the truth of Bernie Madoff, and he's been trying to tell the SEC for years of this. The SEC finally comes, you know, is presented with Madoff confessing all of his crimes, at which point Markopoulos becomes convinced that Madoff will send hitmen to kill him. And so he holes up in his house outside of Boston with like a shotgun and like a bandolier of extra ammunition and a gas mask, literally, and like gun trained at the door, and expects, and then they arrest Madoff, and he's like, okay, the Madoff threat has passed, but now there's the SEC threat. And he becomes convinced that the SEC will send a band of like agents who will bust down his door and do harm to him and his family and steal all of his secret files. Mm-hmm. And so he's still like at the door with the gun, blah, blah, blah. And you realize, is it really worth it? Do you really want to be the guy who saw the truth of Madoff if it means that you're, instead of like spending time with your kids and watching television and going out to dinner with your wife, you are hunkered down with like a bandolier of bullets and a shotgun and a gas mask on, waiting, by the way, for the SEC. The notion that the SEC has at its, has a group of commandos at their disposal who are just waiting to be dispatched to break into homes in suburban Boston and make off with files held by like paranoid hedge fund guys. I mean, the whole thing is just preposterous. So like, this is Levine's point. You know, Markopoulos is right about Madoff, but wrong about life. And so the solution to our, to the problem we have of making sense of strangers is not to turn yourself into a crazy paranoid person, right? It's to suck it up and accept the fact that every now and again, you're gonna get cheated, right? That's a small price to pay for the many wonderful things that comes from being a trusting human being.
So do you think the mountain climber would have had something to learn from Harry Markopoulos? At least one out of those 48 times?
Remember the mountain. What did the mountain climber want to do in Cuba? He talked about this at length. He wanted to create the most effective group of spies in the whole arsenal of the CIA. So he gathered together his group of spies and trusted them because he wanted to inspire them and motivate them. It so happened, so happened that he ran into a particularly shrewd adversary who managed to pull the wool over his eyes 48 times. But if I'm the mountain climber, even there, I'm not sure it's a bad, because he couldn't do his job. I mean, the great paradox of being a running a spy network is you can't do your job if you doubt your own spies, right? In fact, this is I'm obsessed with spy stories, and there's always a moment in every great real spy story, there is always a moment when the very, very best spy ever, because he or she is so good, becomes suspected of treason by their, so it's incredibly, like, remember that guy who the CIA just pulled from Russia a few weeks ago or months ago, whenever, news just came out. We had a spy inside Putin's inner circle who was like, you know, taking photos of Putin's secret documents with his phone. He'd been doing it for 10 years. We finally pull him. They tried to pull him a couple years ago and he didn't want to come, even though, you know, we tried to pull him because we thought he was about to get busted. And he didn't want to come for family reasons. And because of that, the CIA was suddenly, oh, wait a minute, maybe he's a double agent. You know, you can't, so then they were like, well, maybe everything he's told us over the last 10 years has to be discounted. So the point is, like, the minute you start engaging in these kind of mind games, you everything you do is reduced to rubble. Similarly, there was one of the greatest spies in the history of Israel was, Israel had a guy who was like, deep inside the Egyptian government, who told the Israelis in no uncertain terms a series of incredibly valuable info, including he told them when Egypt was going to attack during the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War. But his information was so good, and that it was that eventually the Israelis convinced themselves that it was unbelievable, that he must be lying to them, right? So, like, the point is, it's pointless not to trust because you've got the best spy in the history of spies who's like saying, I'm calling you from the office of the Egyptian president. I'm looking at a order which says they're invading tomorrow. You might want to prepare. And Israel is like, man,
I don't know.
I'm not buying it. It's too good, right? But in much more prosaic ways, it doesn't get you, as a human being, it gets you nowhere to suspect people of trying to trick you. It just doesn't. The only event, I will give one personal caveat to this. Back in the day, it involves my father, who to whom this book is dedicated, and he shows up in various, and my father passed away 2 years ago, so it's that's why he sort of looms large. And but my father, who is a mathematician, and who loved, he was very good with numbers, obviously. And back in the day in the grocery store, when before they had bar scanners, when they would like look at the little thing and then go like this, he would count along with the cashier, and then only if they undercharged him, he would correct them. So they would be like, you know, he's shopping for a family of five. They'd be like 150 things in the thing, and the person is going, my father's going in his head. And then at the end, he would lean in and say, I actually owe you $1.50 more, right? So, but that wasn't suspicion. That was just my dad playing a parlor trick, a kind of mathematician's parlor trick on some unsuspecting cashier. But the point is, though, that you can't get anywhere in the world if that's the way you operate.
There's the idea of deliberate deception, right, like mm-hmm. what you're describing. And then there's also the idea of transparency, the assumption that the person we are looking at is being completely transparent with their emotions. And you cite facial expressions, and you cite Friends, the show Friends, mm-hmm. as an example of how, you know, everybody on that show, when they feel something, they wear it on their face. And there's, you can, like you write in this book, you could watch the show with no sound and figure out how those people feel. But people don't, real people don't act that way. And so that's a different aspect of talking to strangers, in that they're not deliberately trying to deceive. Yeah. They're just not showing you exactly what they feel.
So I did this fun thing. I got an episode of Friends. And Friends is interesting because if you try and describe the plot of an episode of Friends to somebody, you can't. It's too complicated. It's like there's like 17 different things that happen, and there are constantly there's reversals, and like, you know, so then Phoebe says to Joey, and Joey says Rye, right? You're like, what? But if you watch an episode of Friends, no one has ever watched an episode of Friends and said, I don't understand what happened there. Like, it's never happened. So why is it that a show could be so complicated in on the page, but so easy to explain? And the reason is that everything about the emotional life of people in Friends is transparent. And I actually proved this, and I think she might be in the audience. Jennifer, are you in the audience?
I am, I'm right here.
Oh, yes. So I did this fun thing. I got an episode of Friends, and I found there was a group of psychologists who are expert in registering, analyzing, and notating the emotions that are on people's faces. One of those experts is a woman named, a professor named Jennifer Fogarty, who's in the audience, I think. And so I send her, and she was so fun to play along. I sent her a clip of, I think, the, probably the first time, am I right? The first time someone has sent you a clip of Friends to analyze. And I said, here's like 2 minutes of a Friends episode. Walk me through the facial expressions of the people and tell me what's on the face of Ross. When Ross is angry, what's on his face? So what she did was she annotated this, and she revealed to me, sure enough, that when Ross is angry, his face looks angry. When Phoebe is surprised, her jaw drops, her eyes grow wide, and her eyebrows go up. When, you know, when Rachel is, you know, is has conflicted emotion, her face shows conflicted emotions. Everything about that show is completely transparent. That's why you can follow it along. In fact, you can turn the sound off on an episode of Friends, and you will be no further behind than if you listen to the words, right? But that's not how real life works. In real life, people don't perfectly telegraph their emotions on their faces. And so what happens, I think, is that we watch lots and lots of television shows where Joey, you know, is looks every bit as angry as he feels, and we think that's what happens in the real world, and that's not. And what does that do? That leads us to make grave mistakes. And I have a chapter on that chapter where I talk about Jennifer Fogarty's work with Friends is all about, among other things, Amanda Knox. What is the Amanda Knox case about? It is about this. It is about a woman who gets falsely accused of a crime, you know, a young,
the murder of her roommate.
Yes. Murdering her roommate in Perugia, Italy, and jailed for 4 years. Why? Because her facial expressions did not match the expectations that Italian law enforcement and the British tabloid press had of someone whose roommate has just been murdered. They thought They thought if your roommate's been murdered, you're supposed to look and behave a certain way, and she didn't. And they said, oh, she must be guilty.
She Wrong. Didn't act sad. She didn't seem to be sad.
She didn't seem grief-stricken. She seemed angry or weirded out or any number of things. She's just a slightly atypical, gawky, immature teenager. She's not a murderess. And yet, she goes to jail for 4 years. And it makes you wonder how many people in our society are wrongfully judged with catastrophic consequences because they fail to conform to our naive expectations about what emotion is supposed to look like. Now, the reason why this is interesting from the standpoint of talking to strangers is that if I know you, I don't make that mistake. So if you and I have known each other for 30 years, I become aware of all of the ways your facial expressions are idiosyncratic. So maybe you're someone who, when you're super, super interested in something, you actually look bored. And I begin to understand, oh, you look bored, that must mean you're interested, right? And I cut you some slack.
This is a hypothetical.
Hypothetical. But if I don't know you, I say, oh, you're bored, right? And you're not, you're in fact passionately engaged.
I am passionately engaged right now. I just want everybody to know that. And the flip side of that is the example you used in this book of judges seeing defendants in their courtrooms and trying to assess the level of remorse that they seem to have on their face.
Yeah.
And as you write here, judges are worse than rolling the dice, essentially, on how remorseful someone is and how likely they are to reoffend. We're just not good at figuring out how people feel.
Yeah, well, this does not reflect well in the judicial system, because there are various things. You know, one is we ask judges to make bail determinations. Is the defendant in front of me so dangerous that they should be jailed awaiting trial, or so harmless and so remorseful they can be allowed to go free? The whole bail decision is based on the premise that a judge can look at somebody and accurately and usefully determine their likelihood of committing another crime. You can't do that. Right? And sure enough, when you try and assess the accuracy of judges' bail decisions, they're really terrible. Of course they are terrible. That's an impossible thing to ask a human being to do.
One of the things that is that makes it difficult for people to read each other's emotions is alcohol, as you write here.
Yeah.
And you describe it as creating a sense of myopia. It's myopic. Mm. Yeah. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah. So I wanted to do a chapter on campus sexual assaults in this book because it struck me that if I was interested in writing about how conversations between strangers go awry, that was a really big category. Because a lot of campus, not all of them, but a lot of campus assaults begin, campus sexual assaults, begin with a benign encounter of two people meet under relatively normal circumstances and start a conversation, and then at some point later in the evening, you know, something terrible happens. A crime is committed or something else. And so I wanted to understand, well, why are these things happening? When you look at the numbers, then, you know, even the very best and conservative numbers suggest that sexual assaults on campus are way, 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 way out of control, right? Huge. And when I went to talk to people who study them, they all said exactly the same thing, which is like, 5 minutes into the conversation, they would say, well, you have to talk about alcohol, right? I was like, oh, I didn't know that. And they're like, yeah, this is a problem, not wholly the result of alcohol, but in overwhelmingly, these are cases about people who are drunk. They're not too sober people. They're too drunken people. And what alcohol does to you is of enormous significance in this question. So what does alcohol do to you? How does it affect your ability to have a conversation with someone on a dance floor? And our common understanding of alcohol is that alcohol disinhibits, meaning that what alcohol does is it strips away all of the kind of surface constraints and reveals the real you. So you'll say, how many of us have come back from hanging out with some friend who was a little bit tipsy or more, and they told us a series of things they wouldn't otherwise have told us, and our assumption is, oh, what they were telling us is true, because they were drunk and the truth could come out, right? So you think you're seeing, when you see someone drunk, you really think you're seeing is an authentic version of themselves, a more authentic version. Nothing could be further from the truth. The opposite is true. What drunkenness does is it shuts down your higher cognitive processes and leaves behind someone, a person, who can no longer think about tomorrow, can only think about right now, and can no longer think of anything other than the thing directly in front of their face. So it turns you into someone who's myopic. You are, so right now, I don't start swearing or telling off-color stories or being incredibly rude because, among other reasons, I'm aware of the consequences, right? Tomorrow, people will walk around Portsmouth saying, this guy Gladwell's a jackass. And I don't want people to walk around Portsmouth saying I'm a jackass, right? So Malcolm, the real Malcolm, is someone, like all of us, who considers what to do based in part of its long-term consequences, right? That's who I am. I'm someone who takes long-term consequences seriously. That's what all of us are. That's what it means to be a human being. Alcohol destroys that and makes you someone who only thinks about the short term. That is not your real you, right? So now when you think about it, so two drunken teenagers who are having a conversation, they're not themselves in that conversation. So question number one is, if they are not themselves, how can either of them consent to sexual activity? Consent is based on the premise that the person consenting is the real person, right? But if you're not yourself, how can you consent? Problem number one. Problem number two is, if the person who is drunk is a departure from your true self, then you raise the very real possibility that you are capable of doing things while drunk that you would never do while sober. And that is the part of this that's getting lost, that we need to be telling young men, most of all, that if you get super wasted, you are vastly increasing your odds of committing criminal acts, acts that you would never dream of doing while sober, right? And if you don't understand that, when you make the decision to drink, then you are putting your own future at risk and also the future of others at risk. And we have somehow lost this notion. We have now, it's fascinating to look at, there's all this sort of survey data that asks college kids questions about sexual assault and other things, and then asks them what do they think the role of alcohol is in this. And they're indifferent to the role. They don't think alcohol is a big deal in this. They don't think of it in any way as implicated in this problem. And that is bananas, right? You can't get blackout drunk and expect there to be a benign set of consequences. And I think we are, you know, when we look for reasons why all of these harmless encounters are turning so badly awry in campuses, we've got to start with alcohol. And the other thing I would say, the last thing I would say on this, and I could go on and on about this because I feel very strongly about it, is that I think that people of my generation and your generation vastly, we misunderstand how much the culture of drinking has changed in the last 10 or 15 years on campuses. It's not like it was when, no, I'm beginning to sound like the old guy on the couch, right? But it, you know, we have the data. We can, there is a very, very good data on this, and drinking is very, very different. Fewer people are drinking now than used to drink. But those who do drink are drinking far more, and particularly women are drinking far more than they used to. They are now, in many cases, matching men drink for drink, which is
pushing them into blackout territory.
Pushing them into blackout territory, and physiologically, it is madness for women to match men drink for drink. They don't, you know, the differences between men and women are so great that that is essentially creating an outcome where women are vastly more inebriated than men in these settings, and that's not good.